Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode. This event was proudly supported by United States Consulate Melbourne.
Since you all got out of bed early this morning to hear them speak, I'm going to assume that the work of these two women is very familiar to you. They're the authors of books that have kept me company, made me feel hopeful, and emotionally devastated me. Emma Straub is the best-selling author of six novels, including 2022's time travel hit, This Time Tomorrow. She also owns and runs Books at Magic, an independent bookstore with two locations now in Brooklyn, New York. Please welcome Emma. And Gabrielle Zevin is the best-selling author of novels for both young readers and adults, including Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, a stylish, open-hearted love story set in the creative and emotional world of video games. Welcome to Melbourne, you two. I want to begin by mentioning that Emma, in one of your recent newsletters, I saw that Gabrielle had blurbed This Time Tomorrow, and I imagine that Books Are Magic has done a roaring trade of Gabrielle's books as well. So I kind of wanted to begin by hearing about your relationships to one another's work.
Well, okay, so here, I'll start and then you correct me and we can go
I'll
from there.
I'll just talk right over you.
Okay, we can. That's fine, that works. So Gabrielle and I met in a Zoom. I think this is right.
Right. And I said that's the only Zoom in which I've ever made a friend. Because it seemed impossible.
But I feel like there were a few. It was like in the pre-publication zone for both of our books.
It was.
And it was it with Jennifer Egan?
No, it was with Celeste Ng.
It was Celeste Ng.
Yeah.
And it was like for a bookseller's, it was for a bookseller's conference.
It was not.
What was it?
It was for Library Journal's
Day
of Dialogue.
Sorry. They all run together at a certain point, the Zooms with like
but
people
you
love.
But you had done an event with Jennifer Egan before, the month before.
Okay.
But I was not there.
Forgive me. I do, I really get around on the Zoom calls. But okay, so.
I like you imagining that I was there though, you know?
What I remember about it is that I loved your book. And like, it was so, I think what is exciting to me about my two jobs, my writer job and my bookseller job, is that I get to meet so many writers. Like, I mean, I've always known a lot of writers, but now it's just like, the volume is astronomical. Mm. But it's not always true that when I meet a writer, I'm like, I'm obsessed with you, you know? but I will not take credit for like Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow's like astronomical success. Obviously that is inappropriate. But I will say that I was like the number one cheerleader in line, at least in my household and in my bookstore. And I feel like I'm so excited because I feel like there often I love a book and I'm like, you guys, this is the book. This is the book. And people are like, Emma, what are you talking about? But with your book, I was right.
It's the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that is an accurate story now that we have annotated it. I was obsessed with you long before we met. I was saying to you, there's a particular image of Emma that exists in my mind in which she's wearing a very small hat, which I recently realized is called a fascinator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a cool word. But I was obsessed with you. I had read all of your books. I was a fan before I got there and trying to act very cool about about that, you know? And, you know, when I read your book, it really, it just, the most recent one, This Time Tomorrow, it kind of just threw me back to a very particular time in the 90s of living in New York City. You know, I think the first thing in it was that really got me was JFK playing Frisbee in Central Park,
yeah.
You know, which was a
JFK
thing.
JFK Jr.
JFK, right, we're not that old.
It's not that kind of time travel.
But my friend Dan had worked for George Magazine, and so I remember he lived in constant, which was JFK Jr.'s magazine, he lived in constant fear of JFK Jr. showing up to the office with his shirt off, which was like a thing.
Wait,
was that a thing that happened?
It was a thing that happened, you know, and obviously he died not that long after, so it's a sad thing.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was a traumatic thing for my friend Dan.
I mean, fear, hope.
Hope.
Like,
hope.
I would go with hope.
It was, I think it was hopeful, but hope is not always, it can coexist with fear.
Yeah. True.
But in any case, I was in because it's such a precise, you know, it has so many precise details about the Upper West Side at that time, from eating like V&T pizza to, you know, faux wad.
Yeah.
You know, there are all these things that felt like from youth. And I just realized that when I was reading your book, it's not like I want to get to the end at the beginning, but to say like the thing I found so profound about it is that, you know, a good time travel novel isn't actually about time travel at all. Maybe this is true of a video game novel too, you know. The fact that in the end, the time sickness actually gets all of us, you know?
Yeah.
So I loved it and was happy that in the intervening time between when we met and the paperback came out, that I was somehow like useful enough to add to the chorus of voices about the book.
Oh yeah. I don't even really know how it happened. I feel like what happens, I mean, asking for blurbs when you write a novel is like, I would say, a universally abhorred experience.
Like, do you like me? Talk about how you like me.
Yeah, like how much do you like me? Do you like me a lot?
Do you think other people should like me too?
Do you like me enough to like give me compliments publicly?
Yeah, like, and put your name to them?
Yeah.
And technically, this is the Tomorrow Times 4 event.
Right, I know. Tomorrow.
Which it says, that's like, us. There's no tomorrow. Yeah. But really.
Like, there's four tomorrows.
But there's really, like, four of them. There's so many tomorrows, you know. But I do know how I ended up blurbing your book, which was that it's so boring. This is a How the Sausage Was Made kind of thing. But I had said I liked it somewhere. And then your British publisher wrote me and was like, you like it? How much do you like it? Like a dare, and I was like, I like it a lot. I love it, you know. And so,
well, thanks.
Yeah, you
thanks.
Are very welcome.
These are the tomorrows, as I'm now officially calling them when I speak about your books as a little set. They have many things in common, not least of all that they are love stories about people who are not romantically in romantic relationships with one another. But they also explore the idea of wanting to hit restart and experience something or someone over and over again and finding ways to do that. And I would love to go back to kind of the origins of these books and hear what came first for you, the characters or the story and what would happen to them, or was it all one and the same?
You go.
Okay, I'll go. I will say that, you know, I had the idea for Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow before I had the characters, but I had kind of been, you write a lot of ideas down in your little notebooks, and I had written an idea something like, you know, the story of these two people, the video games they make reflect their lives. But on that same day, I can see in my notebook that I also wrote like a bathroom floor plan. You know, because in my house, there was a really tricky three-quarter bath that we were trying to figure out. Like, how do you get that shower and sink in this tiny space, you know? And so it wasn't, like, foremost in my mind, that idea, you know? But the thing about ideas is, and because I've written, you know, 9 other novels before, you realize that it isn't the having of ideas that's hard. It's figuring out which of them will attract other ideas to them, you know? So for me, I will flirt with the thing for a bit. And, you know, by flirting, I mean, I'll look up some stuff about it on the internet, you know, and we'll see if it attracts some other things to it. And so at a certain point, I realized that the entire history of video games was contained within my lifetime. Mm. And so if you could have the story that was the coming of age of an industry, that was also the coming of age of an artist story. And so I realized that to me seemed like an interesting thing. And yet still none of that's enough unless you have characters. And so It took me a long time to find those people. Like, for a long time, I just had a girl and a boy on a train platform. And it wasn't kind of until the pandemic hit that I felt alone enough that I could ignore the fact that so many people would probably not be excited to read a literary novel about video games, you know. And, you know, feeling very alone was the thing that gave me a certain courage to be able to pursue an idea. I think the thing about publishing many novels is, you know, you learn a lot of things, but one of the things you learn is exactly all the ways people can dislike something that you've done. You know, I once made a list, by the way, that was like the 20 types of reviews you find on Goodreads, you know, because there are only 20 kinds of negative. Well, it turns out there's only 20 types of negative reviews. But anyway, but you asked me characters or story first, and I would say I had kind of the idea first, and then the characters came, mm-hmm. and you can have beautiful ideas, and if characters don't attach themselves to them, you have nothing.
Mm. I'll ask about the bathroom later. Yeah. I'm also invested in how that turned out.
I love that. I love that, Gabrielle, because, like, I feel like that's something about writing that, like, I don't know, that we don't talk about, really, that, like, in those little notebooks, it is, like, you are, it's a really interesting look into a writer's brain, because mine looks like that, too, where it's, like, milk, yogurt, eggs, like, novel about blah, 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 or what, you know, just, like, it's, like, a little tiny idea that might go nowhere, or that might, you know, someday sort of accumulate enough energy to actually become something. Mm. Okay, sorry, Brody. What was your question? Your question was about where it came from.
Yeah, the characters or what would happen to them.
So I started this novel when my father was in the hospital, and I had been writing a different book that was like this hilarious romp. And then it was 2020, and nothing seemed hilarious anymore. Mm. And I, even if it had, I didn't have any childcare, and I was home with my two children. So there was no writing happening anyway, mm. so it sort of didn't matter that the hilarious romp had been put aside. But then when my dad was in the hospital, he and I... My father was a writer, Peter Straub. He wrote many, many wonderful, scary books. And he was like, I was like, I don't know what to do. And he was like, you should write a book about a woman visiting her father in the hospital, Emma. And I was like, okay. And and within, you know, a minute, an hour, I don't know, I knew exactly what it was. Mm. Like, it was so clear to me what that story was going to be. Mm-hmm. But then I think, like what Gabrielle said, you know, I had the story, but then I had to figure out the specifics. I had to figure out the particulars. And with this novel, you know, one thing, I think you would probably agree with this, Gabrielle. One really cool thing about being a woman novelist is that
there's one.
Yeah. No, this is the coolest. This is the coolest.
The thing. Yeah.
The coolest thing about being a female novelist is that journalists, humans, will always ask you which character you are. And like that kind of thing. Like, people love it. Right? Wouldn't you say that's like the coolest part? But with this novel, it's true. It's true. And I'm like, I'm that one. I'm that one. That one's me.
I'm the one that's not the dad.
I'm
that's
the one that me. I'm the daughter. I'm the 40-year-old New Yorker with like mm-hmm. blondish hair who what is a mess. Like, that's me. That one's me.
But in a sense, you're one of like the parallel reality versions of her.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not actually like front version of Alice.
Right. Yes. That is some like video game also analysis of this too. But I knew that I wanted to write this story that was very much truly about me and my dad, mm. but I also didn't want it to literally be about me and my dad. Mm. So I had to think about the characters. I had to figure out the ways in which the characters were going to be like us and the ways in which the characters were going to be unlike us. And mm-hmm. and I think the most important choices that I made, I think, were that Alice, who's the main character, that she is single mm-hmm. and child-free, whereas I am married and I have two children, and the father is divorced, and Alice is an only child. Mm-hmm. So I erased everyone else in my family. Yeah. Because it wasn't about my mom, and it wasn't about my husband, and it wasn't about my brother.
You kept your cat.
I kept my cat. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, first things first.
Important, yeah.
But yeah, so that's, I think yes. that answers your question.
It does. Thank you. I'm curious about the references that each of you kind of pulled together when writing about, I know video games is not a genre, but it is a world in and of itself, mm-hmm. and time travel is a genre with many different ways in and rules and things like that. How did you land on like the physics or the rules of your book's specific version of time jumping and everything else? You mentioned you have yeah. references in the book to like Octavia Butler and Peggy Sue Got Married and things yeah. like that.
So the time travel stuff is what I was most worried about because I am not a science fiction writer. Mm-hmm. I'm not. And I mean, it is hilarious to me. This book is occasionally on some lists like top science fiction. And I'm like, oh my God, those readers, that's going to be one of the 20 bad Goodreads types of reviews. People who come to my book looking for like some hardcore science fiction.
Her grasp of physics was not great.
True. No, true.
She got wormholes wrong in these five ways.
But I mean, so what I knew I had to do for myself in terms of solving that problem, every day I would go to the bookstore and I would talk to like my three favorite nerds who work for me, my booksellers. You know, they all play Dungeons and Dragons and like they like know this stuff.
Love.
And I was like, guys, you gotta help me solve time travel. But the way I solved it for me personally is that I just made it like dead simple. Yeah. I made it mm-hmm. as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. And there are a few, like I read so many time travel novels, I watched so many time travel movies and TV shows, and like, you know, there are like, I would say there are like broadly, there are two camps. Mm-hmm. There's like the buttons camp, mm-hmm. which I knew I wanted nothing to do with.
Yeah.
And then there's like a weird, spooky hole camp. Yeah. And I was like, I could do that. Mm. I could do that.
But not in the like time traveler's wife way where like a naked man appears next to a young girl.
I don't want a naked man.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not in this context.
The clothes come with them.
Right. Yeah, no, I didn't want anything too creepy. Yeah, but that was how I figured it out. Was like, how do I make this as simple? I needed it to be as simple as possible so that everyone, myself included, understood what kind of book it was and what was important for the book.
I love there is a clarifying moment where you say, oh, I'm in a 13 going on 30.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I figured it out. Which in Australia, another cultural difference, it's called suddenly 30 here.
Oh, wow. That's a whole different thing.
We could spend an hour there. Yeah. Gabrielle, you have a very robust acknowledgement section in your book of the games that you played, who made them, the books that you read to research. I'm wondering, was writing Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow a culmination of all of the playing and reading that you had done, or once you settled on the idea and not the bathroom renovation, did you know everything that these characters would be playing and doing at the times that you followed them through?
To be clear, I did do the bathroom renovation. Life isn't, you know, wasn't either or in this case. Both could happen. And the bathroom renovation took forever, but not as long as writing the book. Yeah. You know, it went way, anyway. But, you know, for me, I had certainly played video games for 40 years. My dad is a computer programmer, and the first video games I ever played were on a computer that he brought home from work. And I remember thinking, wow, this computer solves a really particular problem for me, which as an only child was solitude. So all of a sudden I had something to play with, you know? And so, you know, cut to 40 years later, I played video games, but I've never thought that was something interesting about myself. Never called myself a gamer. It never appeared in any interview I ever gave. There's not a reference to games in any of my prior 9 books that I know of. And so, in a sense, I never played with an ulterior motive, which is to say I only ever played games because I thought they were fun. But when I started to research this book, I realized that I was going to have to play beyond just what I thought was fun. And so I started to ask everyone I knew, you know, Emma's 3 nerds. No, I didn't ask them. I started to ask everyone I know, what is the most moving experience you've ever had playing a video game? And I began to assemble a canon. And so I really approached it like the English literature major I was in college, you know, which was kind of assembling games across, you know, the 3 decades that are kind of what we think of, and now 4 decades of modern video gaming. And so that was sort of the place I started in terms of assembling that. I don't think of my acknowledgments as comprehensive, by the way, or robust. I mean, they're somewhat robust, but it certainly doesn't have everything in it. You know, in a way, it's just, I think of it as a guide to maybe something, if a reader wanted to explore the subject more, they might find more about it. But, you know, really, if I was to kind of have everything I ever thought about or saw, it would be like thousands of pages, you know, in terms of that acknowledgments, which I reined myself into like 4. So
So it's almost like recommended.
It's more like a recommended, you know, than anything else.
It taught me a lot because also I grew up playing, fighting my sisters to put Rosebud into The Sims to like build a pool. And I never thought of myself as like a gamer, but I was like, oh, I have been playing versions of games my entire life.
Well, it's funny because I think gamer is actually a very gendered term for people. Like we think of one thing when we think of a gamer. We think of a guy and he's in his basement and he's like yelling obscenities over a headset while playing Fortnite, you know, or something like that. But really, you know, more than 50% of gamers are women. They play, they don't necessarily play Fortnite, but they play all kinds of games. And, you know, it, much like in fiction itself, you definitely see a sort of prejudice against the games that women tend to like to play versus the games that, as being the games that people think of as good, you know. And so, in a sense, I think because of the sort of societal expectations, people like you and me never called ourselves gamers, you know.
You mentioned Emma's, like your connection to Emma's book as people who grew up in New York in the 90s or spent time in New York in the 90s. And I thought about that era so much when reading your books and like, especially in terms of technology, the limitations, but also the opportunities that come from that specific time period. And Gabrielle, I've heard you describe that as the Oregon Trail generation. And I'm wondering what the kind of like narrative, not just the limitations, there's no cell phones, et cetera, but like what was the narrative potential in being like, okay, this is where we are, New York City in the 90s or Boston in the 90s?
Oh, I loved the Oregon Trail. I loved it so much.
Do you have an equivalent here of the Oregon Trail? Because I know, like, it's an educational game that was given, played in high schools and in elementary schools and middle schools, but particularly in schools to teach about the Oregon Trail.
Right.
You know, but so in other words, there's a British equivalent of it. I know that it's like some other moment of history, but there, I didn't know.
Is there
Australia,
an Australian
Oregon
game
Trail?
About like the? It would be pretty. Yeah, I was gonna say if it was about the founding of Australia, it would be fucking grim.
Well, it's interesting. Like they recently updated the game for Apple Store. Like Apple has this Apple Arcade, and in it, right at the beginning, it says, you know, the Oregon Trail, which covers the sort of like westward movement of pioneers from the East Coast to the West Coast, and they're basically taking native lands. But the revision of the game starts right at the beginning and says to you, you know, the Oregon Trail was not good for all people.
Yeah.
In a hilarious understatement. But they had tried to address that, you know, by having more Native American characters and things like that in it, you know.
Okay.
That was it, Piri.
I love that. Sorry. No. I feel silly to be like, and what was New York like in the
90s? No. I was trying to remember where we started.
Besides JFK, because also we...
New York in the 90s was great, mostly because I was playing like Oregon Trail in like my computer lab in my middle school. But I think what I loved about writing that time period was that I was able to go back to the freedom that I had as a teenager, which was like, which is unimaginable to me now. Mm. Just, you know, walking out of, making a plan with someone that you would meet them there.
Uh-huh.
And that's all you had.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. And nobody looks up directions because people just know how to get places.
Right. You just know how to get there. And you have picked a time. And if they're late, you don't know if they're going to be there in 5 minutes. Mm. You don't know if you're getting stood up, you know, like you're just going to go to the corner of 82nd Street and Broadway and you are going to wait in front of that Burger King for as long as it takes until your friend arrives.
Yeah.
I loved that. Like it just, especially like, you know, as a like highly like tethered to my devices person and like an anxious person and a parent of small children, like it just, it feels so far away. It feels like more than 25 years, you know, it feels like light years. It feels like centuries away. Mm. And especially during, you know, 2020, 2021, when I was writing the book, like I was like, oh, this is a safe place.
Yeah.
This is a place I understand. I know where everything is. And it gave me a chance to, you know, talk to all my friends from childhood about all of these places. You know, yesterday, people often ask me if there's like anything that I forgot that like I wish I'd put in. Mm. And yesterday I thought of something that was just like a jingle that was on the, that was on television all the time. Mm. And I was like, oh God, why did I not put that in?
What jingle was it? Are you going to tell us?
And in the center of it all is the Milford Plaza. Oh, yeah. You know that one?
I do.
It was for like a terrible hotel.
It was.
Like a terrible hotel. But it, I don't know. I could just hear it in
so
my
jazzy.
Head. And I was like, why did I not put that in?
Yeah.
Because it was just part of my brain. But yeah, it just, it was really like, it was a comforting time period to spend my time in. Mm. What do you think? Like, feel that way?
To me, it's interesting because, you know, we divide up generations as like Gen X, Gen Z, you know, whatever, baby boomer. But really a much more interesting and useful way to divide up generations is by the technology you had access to during that time, you know? And so technically I'm a young Gen Xer, but that means that I would have had, like, when I went to college, the first year of that was the first year of Ethernet in dorms, you know, or you would have had an email address, but not when you were at home, you know, and so I think these are things that kind of bond us more, like, did you have a cell phone, what age were you when you had a cell phone, this kind of thing. So I was kind of thinking about a lot of that when I was writing the book, these kind of things that kind of unite us generationally because of, you know, again, these particular technologies.
Mm, yeah. Emma, as you were speaking, I was reminded that your book takes place not just in New York, but in this bizarre little time warp of a storybook village. Can you tell us very briefly, for anyone who hasn't read the book, what it's real.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. As I was reading your book, I think I messaged you because I looked it up and found two of them for sale on Zillow.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was like, someone needs to buy a house in this weird place.
Well, that's how I did my research.
Yeah.
So there's this tiny little street called Pomander Walk that's on the Upper West Side. It's in the middle of a block between Broadway and West End and 94th and 95th Street, which is in the neighborhood that I grew up in, about 10 blocks away. And it's like these two tiny little rows of like miniature houses.
They're like Dutch. Like
they,
or something?
They look like little gingerbread houses.
Yeah.
In the middle of the block of New York City, hidden behind a gate on either side. So you can't get in. You can sort of peer through the gate and you can be like, what is this? Like, where am I? But you can't actually go in and look unless there's a house for sale, in which case you call the real estate agent and you say, I'm interested in looking at that house, which is what I did. So I went and I looked at this house and I took so many notes and I took so many photos. And this poor real estate agent called me so many times because he could tell that I was really into it.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was.
But not to live in yet.
Well, I was like, God, I mean, it was too small. It's too small. Like, it's too small. It was $2 million. And it was too small for me to, like, move my whole family and my whole life into, and too expensive for me to just like buy as a bonus.
Yeah.
You know, like I wasn't like, okay, I'll buy it. Yeah. You know, like I don't have that kind of bank account.
Uh-huh.
If I did, I totally would have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I totally would have. But it's it just seems to me like a magical place.
Mm.
Like I, you know, there's a gas lamp at the end, you know, like Mr. Tumnus in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Like it's, you peer through the gate and you think, if there are magical parts of New York City, this is one of them.
Mm.
And it just seemed perfect for my purposes. And I haven't been back since, but my editor, my American editor wrote me the other day and she said, you're not going to believe it. I went to a book club on Pomander Walk. And it's like, how do they feel? And I've gotten a couple of messages from people who live there who are psyched.
Great.
Who are psyched.
You'll be welcomed in next time.
Yeah, I hope. Yeah. I hope. I don't know.
Do you think the realtor was on to you though? Like at some point, did he get like vibes that you were a writer?
I don't know. I mean, I guess like all he had to do was like a quick Google.
He could have, yeah.
But I wonder.
He was
I mean,
she is not buying this house.
Right, but like I'm sure he deals with, like most people don't buy the house,
that's
you know?
That's true. No, you are fine. I'm not saying. I was just curious if he got like, you know, this is Nancy Drew here to investigate Pomander Court vibes.
I don't know.
Real estate agents on their little sign-in sheet, they need a box that's like interested in buying or like research.
Yeah. Research.
I am curious to know, not to be a person who says I want to pick your brain, but you are both such prolific authors. You've written across genres. I didn't mention in your intro, Emma, your children's books. And I'm curious to know some of the conditions that you write under when you are maybe not in a pandemic and homeschooling children and running a bookstore, but maybe then too. Like what is your ideal novel writing scenario setup? It's mindset.
Is it in the three-quarter bath?
Yeah.
It's really private in there. There's a shower looming over you, you know. No, it's funny. I think people fall in love with kind of the idea of writers' processes. And I am not in love with that. I've written, as I've said, 10 books, and every one of them's been written a different way. Like, had all these weird superstitions. Like, I had this one book where I was like, I'm going to run a mile for every page I write.
Oh, my God.
I was like, this book needs to end. You know?
Jesus, yeah.
All it did was make it short. You know, this was many books ago, but...
It made it short.
It's like, this is brutal.
This is a prose poem.
But I remember, like, the first...
It's a haiku for me.
The first event I ever did was at a writer's festival in Tennessee, and it was very weird for many reasons, but I did this event with an older female writer, and they asked us a very similar question, and she said, you know, when I write, I like to light a candle, I like to sit on my chaise longue, I play some classical music, and, you know, there was all these things as if she was seducing someone, but basically it was just herself, and at that time, I lived in an apartment in New York City in which, like, there was a big, really ugly couch that I kept having to sew back together. It was a leather couch, anyway, that was kind of like a baseball glove. But I did everything on this couch. I worked on it. I took meetings. I entertained. I threw dinner parties literally on this couch, you know. And I just realized even then that, like, to kind of fall in love with, like, process, you know, it didn't matter. It doesn't matter if it was a horrible process whereby you wrote this book or if it went really, really smoothly and everything came easily. None of that, you know, I think in the end it's just about sort of the book that you write, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm resisting answering that question except to say that I've gotten very unfussy about it as I've gotten older.
Yeah.
You know,
same.
Just making sure you have enough time and space to do it are the only things, you know, really time, right?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yes. Yeah. Hard agree. I mean, I think I have gotten less and less and less fussy with every book.
Yeah, I mean, at first it seems like, with the first book, it seems like a fluke, you know, like, oh, I've written a book. This has happened, you know. And then you have to figure out a process after that, you know. And so they're all after that point, kind of a reaction to the fluke. And then by the third book, you've kind of maybe figured out something about how to do it multiple times.
Mm. Yeah, I will say, though, that there was one time with All Adults Here, which is the book before This Time Tomorrow, I was like, I'm going to let myself be wild because I do like to outline. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't need an outline. I'm a full novelist. Like, I am a grown-up novelist. I've done this several times. I know what I'm doing. I don't need a roadmap for myself. Mm-hmm. And it was a horrible disaster.
How far in before you realized it was?
Oh, no. I mean, I wrote the whole thing. Uh-huh. I wrote the whole thing.
Oh.
And then I rewrote it like 14 times. Like, uh-huh. It was just, I guess what I usually do is I have a clear sense of the project, mm-hmm. whatever it is, like what the idea that I'm sort of wrestling with, mm-hmm. what I think it is. I'm usually wrong. And then I have to go, I mean, which is why, you know, writers don't write one draft. You know, you write a draft and then, I feel like, okay, now I sort of understand actually more what it's about, mm-hmm. than I thought I did. But with All Adults Here, I was like, I was like a child, like following a butterfly. You know, I was like, oh, I'll go over there for a little while. Oh, how about a, you know, 30-page flashback for no reason? I was just being totally indulgent, and it was a horrible disaster. And so I will not do that to myself.
I mean, I love outlining. I outline over and over again. And in fact, you know, if we're talking about that kind of part of the process, there are only two things I really like to have when I'm starting a book, and that's a title and a sense of what the ending could be.
Yeah.
And it's rarely actually that ending. I just like to know that if I take this plane up into the air, that somehow it could land.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
It's like this kind of thing. But with Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, I had neither a title nor a sense of the ending.
Wow.
You know, so I kind of just went into it blind. I think, you know, this will be a really wonky and ridiculous thing to say, but sort of I realized that at a certain point that kind of just outlining a whole thing wasn't sufficient. Sometimes you needed to outline within your outline.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That
yeah.
there are whole like things yeah. that happen. And so that was kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I had really, I don't know, a really a massive number of outlines for this particular book, you know.
That's wild to me because reading your book, there are so many moments, and I know that obviously there are revisions and drafts, but I was so delighted by the way structurally that you would kind of signpost things that were coming later. You know, we hear that something will happen in 2005, but we can't imagine what it will be. You know, before Sam and Sadie start working together, we read a bit of an interview that they give about their working relationship. So you kind of know that big things are happening for these people before you get there. And I'm so interested about the like structural decisions you made in charting this like decades long.
Well,
story
I mean,
of
something
these
I do is that I, as for as long as I can, I read every single page of my work up to the point at which I'm starting again.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I will have read the book by the time it's done, you know, 1,000 times in that range, or more than that, really, you know, and so. And at a certain point, it gets unwieldy to continue to do that. But I'd like to be in the same place that a reader is going to be at the point they reach that place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if anything, over the years, the mistake perhaps I made as a novelist was not realizing that I did not want to spend a lot of time figuring out who these people were as I wrote the book. Like, you need to know who they are from page one. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that is not something that just kind of comes down to you grail-like, you know? you have to kind of do it. And so for me, like, part of doing that is kind of going over and over and over it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tomorrow and yesterday and today and tomorrow.
Well, that's the way in which it is like a, you know, a video game, you know, novel writing. There's some ways in which you have a chance of making a world that is more perfect than the one in which we actually inhabit.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm shocked to see that it's 11:15, so I will be opening up for questions
How
soon.
Is it? It felt so fast.
I know.
We're just a good time, Gabrielle. I hope you guys, I hope you are all having as much fun as we're having. We're having a great time.
This is the easiest job I've ever done. On that question of structure, Emma, there is a point, I was rereading your book to prepare for this, and I remembered the point at which Alice is kind of, the chapters get really short, and they get, there's a page and there's only, you know, a paragraph or a few sentences. Can you tell me a little bit about that moment of structuring a book to speed up and increase like the panic or the almost montage-y feeling of it?
Yeah, well, because, you know, so she goes back, you know, she figures out how to do this, how to time travel in this way. And I knew that she would do it again and again and again, but at a certain point in the book, you understand everything else. Like, you understand how it works. You understand how she gets there. Mm. You understand what most of the day is going to be. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to give all the boring parts. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I didn't want it to be too repetitive.
And in a sense, it's such a great choice because it makes it so immersive, you know?
Thanks.
She's trying to see what she's changed this time as well, you know?
Yeah, it was fun. It was so much fun. Like, I could have written that section for, that section could have been really long. Mm-hmm. And actually, I've been working on the screenplay, and in the screenplay, you know, I mean, it's already sort of, as you said, it's like a montage. It's already sort of cinematic. But I've been having so much fun with that section too.
Yeah.
But I mean, what I love about kind of that decision is at the, you know, we think of time in a novel as being, I don't know, realistic in some way. But in fact, time as it is lived is much more like that montage-y part of your book. And so you have kind of time in a novel and then time more as it is actually lived.
Mm. Yeah.
But I find that part really touching once we get into that part of the book toward the end.
Yeah. And the structure too in the both sides section of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which mimics the structure of the game that's being made, was like, once I realized what you were doing with the chapter 1A and 1B and jumping between worlds, I was like, she's good.
She's good.
She's very good.
She is good.
Yeah. I didn't check if we have roaming mics for we do. Okay, I'm going to ask one more question, and then if you have your hands up, we will come to you next so we can start doing that. Emma, I didn't take much notice the first time I read your book of the dedication at the start, but when I went and looked at it and I Googled Putney Tyson Ridge, I came across your dad's website. Can you tell us what that dedication refers to?
So the whole book is about me and my dad, and I mean, he knew it, and I mean, thank God he lived to see it and read it, and he thought it was so funny. He read it so many times. He's read it more times than anybody else. And so I couldn't dedicate the book to anybody else. That it would have been absurd.
Yeah.
To be like, I wrote a whole novel about you, Dad. It's dedicated to my husband. Like, it just, it wouldn't have made sense. And my husband actually had, it was his idea. And he was like, you should dedicate it to Putney. And it was perfect. So Putney, my dad, at some point in the 90s, I think, my dad created this alter ego, which was like his best friend / nemesis from childhood, who wrote extremely cruel reviews of all of my dad's books that he would post on his own website.
Yeah, that is what I found a letter.
He wrote, I mean, my dad had so much fun with Putney. And so it's Putney Tyson Ridge, PTR, which is Peter without the E's. And I mean, Putney, my dad just loved Putney. Eventually he killed Putney off. It was just great fun. And so I dedicated it to Putney, and I gave it to my dad to look, you know, when he'd read the book before it was a galley. And then when the galley came, that's when the dedication was in it. And he doubled over with laughter. He just couldn't believe it.
My nemesis.
But I love it because it's like most people would be like, oh, that must be someone, a person.
Yeah.
But it's not.
It's a person and also not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we have a question somewhere? I'm going to go down here. So it's a mic just there.
Hi, Gabrielle Zevin, you have died of dysentery. I want to thank you both for writing, first of all, for writing the two highlights of my 2022. Thank you very much. Gabrielle, especially, I feel like you've written the Cavalier and Clay of its generation.
Hell yeah.
Also, just wanted to ask, because so many of Sadie's games in the early part of your book are so vivid, the poetry shooter and solution especially, which just made me rethink the Holocaust completely. Has anyone actually prototyped any of the games, like Ichigo, anything like that? Have you seen anything like that?
Well, my publisher made a promotional version of Emily Blaster. So that's the Emily Dickinson kind of math blaster shooting game, basically, that you can play on my website. So that was kind of a cool thing. But no, nobody's really made any of the other games. I feel like there would be major issues with making Solution for a mass audience.
Yeah.
If you know it. But all the rest of the games, you know, I would certainly be open to that. But the thing about making a video game novel is I'm one human, and so I don't actually have to have the burdens of an actual game designer, which is to say a team of 100, five years minimum of sort of development into production. And so I was able to kind of cut out so many parts of the process in terms of saying, like, it works because I say it works. Yeah. It's fun because I say it's fun. But I don't know that any of these things would be fun or work in actual life, you know. So no, at this point, I've had some people reach out to me. I think there's some interest in maybe making particularly Ichigo or one of those games. But but we'll see.
I will say there was a tournament. There was small tournament of Emily Blaster amongst indie booksellers. And I was like, this is in the bag. And I lost in the first round.
How did your three nerds go? Did they play?
They did. No, I was like my store's representative.
Oh, I mean, I felt I was rooting for you so much. And I think that the people that like won, I know that they practiced extensively. Yeah. They put in the time much more than you did.
Okay.
You know?
True. Rigged. Okay.
The prize, this will only make sense to those who read the book, but the prize was a crystal heart declaring you Emily Blaster champion, you know? Which I wanted to send you one anyway. Because as I think in a way, like, you know, there are only a few people. You asked about this at the beginning. There are only a few people that are like real like tastemakers, I think. And Emma is one of them. Mm-hmm. And so when Emma went around saying like, you should read this book, that was part of a huge thing that kind of made people that otherwise would have said, I don't wish to read the Cavalier and Clay of video game novels. You know, I have no desire to read this. Video games are, again, those guys in the basement. What do I have? What does this have to do with my life? I mean, I think, you know, her voice particularly was probably one of two of the most important people.
Yeah,
to the other one to champion the book.
Just kidding. Yeah, agreed. No one whose book recommendations I screenshot on Instagram stories.
You can trust Emma Straw. You can, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Did we have any other questions in the audience? Oop. I think maybe one down here and then one in this area somewhere.
Hello, thank you. This has been awesome. I just wanted to say thanks to Gabrielle for writing a book about games that puts them forward as art. I'm a video game producer, and as a woman, that's really hard sometimes, but your book was hugely restored my faith in what I was doing, so thank you. My question is, what is your favorite game that you're playing at the moment that has really moved you? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and it makes me really happy to hear that. I always feel really excited to hear from video game designers because it's as if, like, you know, I'm not a video game designer. Again, although I am the child of a computer programmer, it just feels as if, like, I did a good job researching it. You know, I feel validated by that. My favorite game that I'm playing, I've been on the road almost constantly, so I'm not really near a console very much, which means I'm just playing things on the road. So what I'm playing at the moment is a game by Kairosoft, and the game is called Manga Works. And you play like a person who is designing manga, and you make a series of things. It's kind of like being a little manga publisher or something like that. And I will say, even though I certainly can appreciate big immersive games, when I'm playing for myself, I'm happy to just be like, you know, a Japanese grandma running a kitchen or you know, somebody who works in manga or somebody, like, I am happy to just do something that's kind of a tiny little RPG as much as I am to go and, like, shoot something across 60 hours, you know, so.
I went through a phase of playing that game where you just put out little cushions and the food for cats to come and eat.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd check back in the next day and you'd be like, they left me a fish. I said, thank you. And we had a question up here somewhere. Yes, in the middle there.
Thank you. Firstly, thank you so much for your time. It's been, yeah, really interesting and so much fun. So my question is, what is a genre that you would like to explore in future novels that you haven't already?
Complicated people.
I told Brody yesterday that I discovered that people are complicated.
She was like, I'm going to write, my books are going to be so great now.
it's an interesting question because writing this book, like, I never, ever, ever thought that I would write a time travel novel. So I have been thinking about it a little bit more, like, sort of in the way that you asked it. Like, I have been sort of asking myself, like, what other sort of rooms that already exist can I walk in and explore and sort of play with in my own way? I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer right now. Like, when I was in my 20s, I wrote a murder mystery. I guess they call them mysteries. And it was so bad. No one would publish it. It was terrible. It was like Patricia Highsmith. It was like a facsimile of Patricia Highsmith. But I would love to do that again. I would love to do that again someday. But I don't think I'm ready. What about you?
I mean, when I hear a question, first of all, I'm fascinated by your murder mystery. And I would completely read that because I think what it points out to me is, like, I don't read a ton of science fiction and fantasy. So I get really excited when a more voicey writer, like, takes their pen to it.
Yeah.
You know? And so for me, like, that's what I want in a time travel novel, some weird neuroses on the Upper West Side, you know?
Yes.
So I'd be excited for your murder mystery as well, I'll say that. But when somebody asks me about genre, my mind goes into a strange spiral where I start thinking, well, what is genre?
Yeah.
You know? And so in a way, I don't think I think about writing in terms of genre, you know, like, maybe more I think about it in terms of subject or character, but it's certainly not the first thing I think about. Like, and in a sense, you know, it's a useful thing to not know what genre you're in, even though it's not useful for selling the book ultimately, of course, but it is useful to be surprised. You know, I think life, you can think you're in one story, but eventually all of our stories turn sort of sci-fi or even fantasy in terms of the fact that we all die. You know, like, a life has many different... I'm sorry.
Breaking news.
Life has many different genres in it, you know? We don't all get to kind of live our lives confined to one thing, you know? But so I don't have a great answer to that question, though I just gave a rambling,
no, I liked
long
it.
Answer.
It was dark.
It got dark at a certain point. And I didn't know would I be able to bring it back around.
But you did.
But I hope we did.
All right. I've got one final question. There is a point late in This Time Tomorrow, or maybe mid This Time Tomorrow, when Alice has figured out how to use time travel. She's enjoying the good parts of it, eating with her dad, smoking cigarettes with her friends. And it was a moment that really linked your two books for me, because both Alice and Sam have found this way to avoid the finality and inevitability of death and the end of a life. Alice through time travel, Sam through games that offer endless restarts and reboots. And I'm curious to hear about a time that you would like to return to, the beginning, experience something over again, that kind of wish fulfillment that both of your books offer in some ways.
Well, I'll go first.
Okay.
You know, I've thought about this question quite a lot because I think, frankly, I was an idiot for most of my life. And then at a certain point, I got smarter. You know, and you think about it even in terms of the fact that when your first novel comes out, it's your first novel, but you don't necessarily know everything about novel writing yet, and yet you kind of get better at it, ideally, as you go along, and that would be useful maybe if I could go back in time to then write all of those novels again. But then I thought about that, and And it really stressed me out, you know? I'm like, would I have to try to remember them? And would I just be trying to transcribe them? And what, like, and so I realized that it would be sort of impossible to go back in time to any particular point. And so, unfortunately, we are all stuck with time as it is lived, you know? And as I mentioned, the, what is it? The time sickness gets us all in the end, you know?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think that, what I sort of realized, or I don't know, came to while writing this, is that we all time travel all the time. You know, we time travel. I mean, our phones force us to time travel now because they're like, on this day, 10 years ago, look how cute your baby was, or whatever, you know.
Or when you take the return flight, you're going to arrive before you left, you know.
I mean, and who at Apple decided we needed like a Proustian memory machine all the time, you know? Like, I don't want to have all those feelings when you're just like walking through your day. You're like, oh, you know, anyway.
Yeah. But I don't mind it. At least right now, I don't mind it, you know, where I'm like, there's my cat. There's my dad.
Yeah.
You know, like all those things.
It all happened. It all settled it all into place.
Yeah.
Yeah. On that note, I'd like you to join me in thanking Emma and Gabrielle.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.